Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'll ask the marshal to call us in.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bratfeld, Judge Larkin, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Diane Bratfeld presiding.
Again, good morning. Today's date is September 23rd, 2021. We have five matters on our oral argument calendar today. We have a break scheduled after the third oral argument. I see the lawyers are here for the first matter, and so I'll ask the marshal to call that case. I'll have just a few remarks before we start the arguments.
Now calling case A21-0300, Department of Corrections versus Nathan Knutson in the Bureau of Mediation Services.
Right, and as counsel are well aware, we are hearing this matter over video conferencing technology today via Zoom due to the pandemic. Now, all of our procedures remain the same with the exception of that one, so that we are not conducting these proceedings in a courtroom, but we are otherwise following our regular courtroom procedures. And with that, I'll just remind you of a couple of things you're probably well aware of. But before you start your remarks, remember that this is an audio recording that is preserved and then posted on our website. So you will want to identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you begin your argument. And then keep your eye on the clock, which should be visible on the screen so that you watch your time. The conversation tends to go quickly. And then the last thing I'll mention to you is that I know that you have checked your connections and you have instructions in place if there were to be something that would interrupt your connection to the court during the course of the argument. And you should ask questions if you have any about that, but otherwise just follow the instructions you've been given. And of course, we'll endeavor to stay together for the course of this argument. So with that, I think we're ready to hear from counsel for the appellant.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Leah Tabbert, and I'm an assistant attorney general representing the relator in this case, the Minnesota Department of Corrections. In a decision reinstating respondent Nathan Knutson to a high-level position at the Department of Corrections, the arbitrator in this case misapplied the standard governing his decision, disregarded the plain language of the statutory code of ethics for executive branch employees, and excused Knutson's serious misconduct for reasons that were not supported in the record. In this certiorari appeal, the Department of Corrections asked this court to reverse that decision and reinstate the decision of the Commissioner of Corrections discharging Knutson for cause. Now, there is a detailed factual record in this case, and I don't want to take up the court's time reiterating everything that the record shows. With the time I have today, I want to talk about three key errors that the arbitrator made. And to be clear, the court should look at these errors from the lens of the standard of review for a certiorari appeal, because that's the only standard of review that applies in this case. Now, the first error that the arbitrator made was disregarding the plain language of the statutory code of ethics. The arbitrator's own factual findings show that Knutson attempted to use his position at the Department of Corrections to obtain benefits for himself and for organizations he was associated with. And under the plain language of the code of ethics, that is a conflict of interest. The arbitrator determined that no code of ethics violation had been proven, largely because Knutson had not been successful in obtaining any of the benefits that he sought. But the statute encompasses both the use and attempted use of one's position to obtain benefits. So that is an error of law. And it's a serious error of law because the statute also states that employees who violate the code of ethics shall be subject to discipline. So the arbitrator essentially decided that the code of ethics violations weren't that big of a deal, but the legislature has decided that they are, and the arbitrator didn't have authority to substitute his own judgment for that of the legislature. The second key error that the arbitrator made was excusing Knutson's pattern of undermining the integrity of investigations and excusing that misconduct for reasons that were not supported in the record. So the first instance we have of Knutson undermining the integrity of investigation came with new evidence that emerged after he had been removed from his assistant commissioner position, which showed that he had lied to the investigator in that first investigation. And the DOC policy is clear and explicit that lying during investigation is cause for discharge. The arbitrator completely disregarded that misconduct and took it out of the equation on the finding that Knudsen had already been punished for that. But that's inconsistent with the record because the record shows that this evidence didn't emerge until after his removal from the assistant commissioner position.
So, Ms. Tabbert, if I may, do we have to reach that issue, which is disputed about whether this evidence is new or not? I mean, isn't this case different from kind of the rules that we govern in labor arbitration or where there's a collective bargaining agreement where you have, I mean, I'd just like to understand the department's position on that.
Yes. So our position is that not only is it an error of fact because this is new evidence, but it's also an error of law because this was not a labor arbitration. And so the rules governing labor arbitration, for example, the double jeopardy rule that the arbitrator referred to, did not apply. So that's another reason why the arbitrator should have taken into account the misconduct that was shown of Knudsen lying to the investigator in the first investigation.
So, Ms. Tabbert, if I can follow up, why wouldn't the logic of the court's reasoning in the, is it Skeen versus Independent School District number 115 apply here? I understand that it doesn't, it's not technically precedent because that was a labor context, but why wouldn't that logic apply here?
The logic being double jeopardy generally?
Yes, double jeopardy. I think it was about a proper penalty if imposed once easily becomes harassment if it's dealt out piecemeal.
I understand. I think that it's important to be clear that the first investigation showed that Knudsen had deleted records on his phone, and that was part of the reason for the removal. In the second investigation, he wasn't being repunished for deleting those records. The new evidence showed that not only had he deleted his records, but he had lied to the investigator about it. So it was that inconsistency between the explanation given in the first investigation and the new evidence that showed a new instance of misconduct, the lying to the investigator. So that was the first instance that the arbitrator improperly disregarded. And then the second instance came when Knudsen violated the no contact directive repeatedly after he was placed on investigative leave. And the record is clear that Knudsen made over a dozen calls to four different employees in the DOC within the first 2 days after being placed on leave. The arbitrator generally excused that conduct for a few reasons, and those reasons are not supported in the record. First, the arbitrator found that interference with the investigation was only partially proven because there was no evidence that Knudsen had actually succeeded in impeding the investigation. But
Thank you. Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but our time is limited, and I do have a few questions. So could you just give us your third key error before we get into the details of each one so we have an opportunity to ask some questions?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
I think we've gone through one and two. What's the third key error you want us to focus on?
Sure. The third one is simply the arbitrator failed to account for the nature of Knudsen's position, which was a high-level position of public trust. And under the Delhi University of Minnesota case, under the Delhi case, public employers are entitled to some discretion in determining whether misconduct by high-level employees in positions of public trust renders the employer unable to retain them. The arbitrator, basically substituted his own judgment and his unsupported belief that Knudsen could be trusted and probably had learned his lesson for the discretion of the Commissioner of Corrections.
So, and one of the first questions I have for you, and it follows, I think, on the heels of Judge Jessen's question, is what law does and does not apply here. I've read our decision, in this case, Minnesota Department of Corrections versus Knudsen, and it's clear that this court determined that the review of the arbitrator's decision is by writ of certiorari, and the standard of review that controls is that under MAPPA, and it's the proceedings aren't governed by UUA. But the question I have is, from that decision of our court, does it follow that all law regarding labor disputes, which arose in the context of arbitration, has no application here? In other words, as Judge Jessen asked, well, what about the kind of the logic behind the double jeopardy rule? That seems to be more of a substantive rule than a procedural rule. Why is it that that larger body of law governing labor disputes does not apply here simply because we've said the method of review is by writ of certiorari rather than to the district court, as it would be between an arbitration that the parties agreed to.
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that it's not simply because of this court's determination that certiorari review is proper. It's because the hearing that took place arose from a statutory right rather than from an agreement to arbitrate. So the parties did not reach an agreement to be subject to the law of arbitration. The legislature passed a statute that said certain employees subject to certain kinds of discipline can have, you know, a determination made at the Bureau of Mediation Services.
But
so
did this court say, I mean, I'm reading our decision and I'm asking myself, okay, we essentially said, where do you go for review? Do you go to the district court or do you go straight to the Court of Appeals? I'm not sure that this court considered or decided whether the legislature meant to foreclose all substantive law that would govern a labor dispute, which has arisen in the context of arbitration cases. Do you read
sure,
our
Your
decision
Honor.
That way?
I wouldn't read so much into the decision, but I think it's clear from the statute, because the statute states not just a specific standard, you know, that they have to look for just cause. If there is just cause, they need to find extenuating circumstances in the records if they want to modify. It provides a very clear standard such that you don't need to pull from labor arbitration law. And it also defines just cause.
Does it define extenuating circumstances?
It does not define extenuating circumstances.
Right. So did the arbitrator err then in looking to labor law to determine what sort of reasons would justify something short of termination?
I believe that he did, because there were no explicit extenuating circumstances identified.
Okay, and so let's just get past that, because the arbitrator did not say there are extenuating circumstances, here they are. But the arbitrator did say, for these specific reasons, I think termination of employment was too harsh a consequence. Now, clearly, he didn't say these were extenuating circumstances, but how are we to decide whether the reasons he gave are or are not extenuating circumstances if extenuating circumstances has not been defined by the legislature in this context? Is it wrong then to look to labor law to determine what sort of circumstances justify a reduced punishment?
Your Honor, I don't think that a definition of extenuating circumstances is necessarily required to evaluate the arbitrator's decision here, because even if you interpret his findings on reasonableness or proportionality as extenuating circumstances, you'll find that they aren't supported by the record. So, for example, this is one of the things that I wanted to get to in my second point. The arbitrator found that Knudsen had stopped violating the no contact order after Austin Neese called him in the afternoon of March 9th. And there's uncontradicted evidence in the record that, in fact, Knudsen continued violating the directive and called Gino Anselmo the next day.
Understood. So, but the arbitrator also found that this is a person who had a 20-year history with the Department of Corrections, never before had any sort of complaints or infractions, described as a great employee. People can disagree on whether he was still distraught 2 days after being told, okay, you're being demoted, and a half hour later, we're starting a new investigation. You may not talk to anybody. Now, whether, you know, the arbitrator was wrong in thinking, you know, the sort of emotion that went with that circumstance carried through or would have carried through, I don't know. But I mean, I'm having a hard time saying, well, we should reject the arbitrator's reasons because the arbitrator didn't use the word extenuating circumstances. And at the same time hearing you say, well, we really don't need to define extenuating circumstances. I mean, how do we evaluate this? That is, how do we evaluate the arbitrator's decision?
Right. So, I mean, under the certiorari standard, findings of fact that are not supported by the record are ground for reversal. So are mistakes of law.
You've convincingly argued that he did have contact after he was told not to. But other reasons were given. What do you say to those other reasons?
Right. So one of the other reasons was his long years of service. And you know, as we argued in the briefing, that doesn't support reduction of the discipline here, because the record is clear that Knutson, during his long tenure, was responsible for enforcing the very policies that he violated. So there can be no argument that he didn't understand what was required of him. And, you know, he was expected to set an example. He had in the past fired people for interfering with investigations. And so for that reason, the, you know, the long history of employment at the Department of Corrections, we would submit, doesn't actually help him. And furthermore,
so that,
you know,
that sort of goes to how do you weigh that fact? So it's undisputed mm-hmm. how long he worked there and his history, but it's how do you weigh it? You're saying it should be weighed against him. The arbitrator thought it should be weighed for him. Okay, under the MAPA standard, what do we do with that?
I mean, under the certiorari standard, you know, the findings of fact need to be supported in the record. And additionally, I would
establish there's the factual finding, in my view, is he's worked there for 20 years with no problem. There are two ways to interpret that, either as, well, against him because he should know better, or in his favor because he's never had an infraction. The arbitrator chose to interpret it one way. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that we can say, well, that's an erroneous factual finding, because that's not a factual finding. That seems to be how do you weigh the evidence?
Well, I think this is one instance where the Delhi case is instructive, because the Delhi case provides that, you know, the Commissioner of Corrections had discretion to determine whether a high-level employee who had breached the trust of his employer could be trusted to remain at the DOC. And the arbitrator's decision makes clear that he had no regard for the discretion of the Commissioner of Corrections in this case, and you know, completely disregarded the fact that Knutson could no longer be trusted based on, you know, not just one, but several violations of trust. As I stated before, he had developed a pattern of undermining the integrity of investigations, and that's very serious misconduct, as testified by Terry Hable.
Can I ask one more question, and perhaps it can be answered on rebuttal if necessary, but as an alternative form of relief, you ask for a remand for a new hearing before a different arbitrator. What in your view would be the purpose of that remand and new hearing? And why could that
be? May I respond, Your Honor?
You may. Go ahead.
Okay. So the court has broad discretion in the context of a certiorari review. And we would submit that the decision ought to be reversed. But if the court is inclined to remand for, you know, rehearing of the evidence supporting Knutson's discharge, we would request that it be before a different arbitrator, because the arbitrator's decision in this case was a demonstration that they were driven by will rather than judgment. So that's the reason for our requesting that relief.
Well, that's ironic, because the arbitrator thought the DOC was driven by will rather than judgment. I mean, what would you have us say to the arbitrator who might hear this case on remand in terms of providing clarity as far as what the arbitrator can and cannot do, what law may or may not be applied, those sorts of things? Because it seems to me that many of your assignments of error are legitimate, but it's also, these errors to me are understandable because we're sort of in a gray area, right? Well, okay, it's arbitration, but it's not arbitration. Some things aren't defined, but they're defined in case law that stems from arbitration. Can we use that or not? And we've not really delved into those issues here. This court didn't delve into those issues in its decision saying the case should come here for review. So what guidance would we or should we give if, and I'm not saying we would, this case were to be remanded?
May I respond briefly?
Go right ahead.
Okay, thank you. I think the guidance would be that the arbitrator should stick to the standards stated in 43A.33 and, you know, apply the statutes and policies governing Mr. Knutson's employment as they are written. And I'll await my rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. I just want to check to make sure, is everyone's connection working well, or are you having some difficulties hearing? I occasionally, Ms. Tabbert, your connection for me is garbled, but maybe that's just me. I can definitely hear you and understand you. Everyone else doing okay? All right. All right. So with that, I think the clock has been reset and we are ready to hear from respondent. You can proceed, Mr. Tanak.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Marshall Tanak. I represent the respondent, Nathan Knutson, in this proceeding. As the court is aware, Mr. Knutson has had a long and very successful career with the Department of Corrections, starting from the time he was an intern while he was in college. He's worked there for more than 20 years. And during that time, he had what the department itself described as a meteoric rise through the ranks and was uniformly deemed to be an excellent employee. The terms great and hardworking and extraordinary were all used by the department in the hearing to describe his work. He was terminated after an investigation was conducted that Arbitrator Beans probably deemed to be among the most horrible investigations one can imagine. I want to just mention something about Arbitrator Beans. This is in the record. He's been an arbitrator for 50 years. He has heard more than 400 arbitrations. In this case, he held a four-day hearing with numerous witnesses, about a dozen for each side, and developed a 756-page transcript. This was not a thoughtless, inadvertent decision by Arbitrator Beans, but a well-reasoned one by a very experienced arbitrator. He noted in his decision that the investigation that prompted the termination of Mr. Knutson was, in his words, deeply flawed, shoddy, incomplete, cherry-picked, biased, piling on, lacked good faith. Those are pretty strong words coming from an experienced arbitrator. I've arbitrated a few cases myself and been in a number of arbitrations, and I don't think I've ever seen language like that coming from an arbitrator as to any investigation. So Arbitrator Beans, based on his experience, saw this investigation as being, in his words, deeply flawed and totally baseless. Furthermore, the commissioner testified in the proceeding that the decision to terminate Mr. Knutson was based, quote, solely and completely, unquote, on the investigation. That's volume 3 of the transcript, pages 368, 369. So you are presented with a case here, Arbitrator Beans was presented with a case in which a longtime, excellent employee of the Department of Corrections was terminated for one reason. The only reason was the investigation. The investigation.
Mr. Tannick, I hesitate to interrupt you. I see your point because, of course, the arbitrator did make comments that you just described, and I'm familiar with them and the criticisms of the investigation. But it seems to me that the DOC in its appeal is not relying on the parts of the investigation that the arbitrator criticized, and instead looking at the arbitrator's, the points of the arbitrator's decision that actually agreed with the investigator's determination. So there were violations found. And I think it's important for you to turn to those violations and the arbitrator's analysis for what was the appropriate result.
Sure, be happy to. Yeah. And in terms of the arbitrator's analysis, I know this court has so far ruled, or has ruled, that this is a certiorari standard. Incidentally, we have asked for a review of that before the Supreme Court, and that's pending as to whether the standard should be an arbitrator standard under the Uniform Act or the certiorari standard. But I know this, and that's pending before the Supreme Court, which is kind of an awkward situation to be in before this court. But nonetheless, regardless of which standard is applied here, the result ought to be the same. And I'll apply the certiorari standard here because that's what the court says applies. This case is not one where Arbitrator Beans made an arbitrary, capricious decision. He did not deviate from substantial evidence. His decision was not unreasonable.
Why don't you start, Mr. Tannick, with, I think it was Ms. Tabbert's first argument. So the arbitrator, for instance, with respect to the policy prohibiting using a position to secure a benefit for himself personally for an association that Mr. Knutson's associated with. The arbitrator did make a finding of a violation. So why don't you start there?
Sure. There were five charges. The arbitrator found that four of them were wholly unproven and baseless. That's what the arbitrator found. He said four times in his decision of the five charges, no violation, no violation, no violation, no violation. So he didn't find any violation as a matter of fact, as a matter of law.
Are you going to talk about the chair, Mr. Tannick?
I can talk about the chair. Again, the arbitrator analyzed the chair. Mr. Knutson asked about how much it would cost to have a chair made to donate to an organization, a charitable organization. he was told the price.
Right, a charitable organization that he was associated with. Right,
and he was told the price of that, and he said, "Wow, that's an awful lot," and he didn't pursue it at all. Nothing happened.
Is it a legal error of the arbitrator to have not recognized that he attempted to use his position to obtain a personal benefit for an association with which he is associated? That's the question.
Well, the facts are he didn't attempt. He asked a question as to how much it would cost. He was willing to pay for it. He was told.
How many text messages are in the record with regard to the chair?
I didn't count the text messages. I think it is notable that the investigator never interviewed the individual who was responsible for making the chair, for doing the chair. His name is Al Larson. Mr. Larson testified in the hearing that he didn't consider that to be any kind of overreaching or conflict on Mr. Knutson's part. That happens all the time. He's often asked, he says, by employees if particular things that are made at the prison can be used or donated or even purchased. So Mr. Larson, the person who was involved in making the chair, was not interviewed by the investigator, credibly testified, according to the arbitrator, that there was no overreaching, no conflict. He didn't think anything of it, and nothing happened as a result of that. Another similar incident, Your Honor, that is in the record, it concerns this Timberwolf basketball. Again, Mr. Knutson heard that the Timberwolves were coming to a presentation at one of the prisons. Mr. Knutson purchased a basketball and asked if the Timberwolves would be able to sign it. Mr. Knutson intended to give that basketball to the employee association who did an annual kind of social group that did a drawing for prizes. So Mr. Knutson wasn't seeking anything for himself. He bought a basketball, and the event never occurred. The Timberwolves didn't show up. It was those kind of situations that Mr. Knutson didn't do anything wrong, and the arbitrator so found. In each of the so-called claim violations for seeking benefits, nothing ever happened. On one occasion, Mr. Knutson was given, without even asking for it, some notepads that the department made and gave to everybody without any charge. So I think that's reflective, Your Honor, of what the arbitrator said about the investigation, which formed the basis for the termination, that it was piling on, it was cherry-picked, there was a bias on the part of the investigator, and so on and so forth. None of those violations were found by the arbitrator who existed. Now, the department, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Mr. Tanik, if I may, I just want to go to another, what I see more as a legal issue, and that is a question of whether the arbitrator's legal determination that double jeopardy applies. Mm-hmm. And my concern is twofold. Not only here are we not in a statutory provision, not collective bargaining agreement situation, but even more so, we're talking about an employee who was removed from the unclassified service as an assistant commissioner by the commissioner, and then obviously had bumping rights into the classified service, and then was they sought his removal as from that classified position. And so, shouldn't that be a different situation? I mean, if as a commissioner you remove somebody because, let's just say, something much more egregious, it was sexual harassment here. There was an investigation of finding a sexual harassment. The commissioner says, you're no longer assistant commissioner. And doesn't have to give any reason for that, right? Because it's an unclassified appointed position. Employee bumps back. Why shouldn't you be able to use that finding in that context as a reason for discharge? I just, could you help me with this?
Sure. First of all, the arbitrator did take that into account. In volume one, page 27, the arbitrator said that he was taking into account the prior disciplinary or removal of Mr. Knutson from that position. So the arbitrator did say, I'm taking that into account. That was his own words, firstly. Secondly, I think there's a misconception perhaps on what the standard is here. The statutory standard is just cause. It's not defined, but it's a well-known conventional term used in arbitrations, not just labor arbitrations, but other kinds of arbitrations. There's a whole body of 100 years of law concerning what constitutes just cause. And those just cause considerations and the rationale behind them are applicable, whether it's a collective bargaining agreement or some other kind of dispute, such as rising under a contract. Many employment contracts have the term just cause, even though they're not part of an employment collective bargaining agreement. So the arbitrator applied conventional considerations under just cause. One of the considerations under just cause is the propriety of the kind of punishment that's being imposed. So the arbitrator called it double jeopardy because that's a well-known subset of just cause. It's kind of borrowed from the criminal law, of course, but it means that you can't punish someone twice for the same offense. That's a well-known part of just cause, and the arbitrator applied that, and that was his job. That's why we selected him to do that. The arbitrator did what he was supposed to do.
Mr. Tanik, if I may follow up on that. So if we were determined that double jeopardy did apply here, you know, perhaps, as you're saying, because it is part of what can go into just cause, would you agree that would be precedential? I mean, should this be a precedential opinion then? Because I don't see that addressed previously by our case law.
Well, I don't know if it's precedential. I think it's well established that just cause consists of a constellation of factors, as does extenuating circumstances, which I'll address in a moment. So just cause consists of the propriety of the punishment, the harshness of the punishment, the proportionality of the punishment, and the so-called double jeopardy, which is a term that, you know, borrowed from criminal law. Double jeopardy in the context of an arbitration simply means that a person shouldn't be punished multiple times for the same alleged offense. I don't think that's precedential. I think that's well established within the concept of just cause. So, and that wasn't a critical consideration in this case anyway, because the arbitrator said he took that prior incident into account. Furthermore, on the facts here, the facts were not altogether clear as to whether there was any kind of misrepresentation at all by Mr. Knutson. I don't want to dig too deeply into the 765-page transcript, but the commissioner argued that Mr. Knutson had deleted some phone records in the first investigation, and that it was in February, about a month before he was terminated. However, the commissioner's human resources director stated that a month later, Mr. Knutson gave her his phone, and that was when the deletion occurred. So the record was pretty ambiguous as to whether there was any deletion at all. But nonetheless, the arbitrator said he took that into account and factored that into a decision. And that's where the extenuating circumstances, I think, plays a significant role here. Extenuating circumstances are specifically addressed in the statute. So, I think it's a kind of a two-pronged analysis. The first, in which the arbitrator did, was there just cause for some discipline? And the arbitrator found that one of the five charges was partially proven, so kind of half a charge, if you will. But the arbitrator said there was partial proof that justified some type of discipline. And that's consistent with the statute and consistent with the law. Just cause is not an all or nothing concept. Just cause simply means that an arbitrator can impose some kind of discipline. Indeed, the ethics code that the state talked about does not mandate dismissal. Even if there was a violation of the ethics code, which the arbitrator found didn't exist, so the arbitrator found as a matter of fact that there was no, and law, that there was no violation of the ethics code. One of the points there was that Mr. Knutson asked for a mouse pad to be made for a friend of his, and the gentleman who was in charge of the mouse pad said, sure, we'll do that for you. It costs 32 cents for the mouse pad, pretty de minimis, but nonetheless, the arbitrator found that that was not a violation. The ethics code that the commission relies on says that an individual who violates the ethics code, and there were no violations there, is subject to discipline. It may be subject to discipline. It doesn't say that there has to be discipline, nor does it say what the discipline is. So the arbitrator in this case determined not under the ethics code because he found no violation, but he found that there was a partially proven violation of contacting people after he was told not to. The arbitrator then applied traditional conventional considerations of what constitutes extenuating circumstances, which the statute expressly empowers him to do. And those considerations are well established in just cause law. the length of service.
Mr. Tanik, if you would, I see your time is running down. If you would just summarize what you consider to be the extenuating circumstances that the arbitrator considered.
The length of service is always considered as a just cause extenuating circumstance. It was here. The work performance of the employee, which was described here as excellent, that's a well-established consideration of extenuating circumstances. The lack of any actual harm, which the arbitrator found and which the commissioner testimony agreed with. There was
no
harm.
You mean harm to the investigation?
Right.
All right.
Okay. The arbitrator found there was no harm. He said there was a lack of any material harm. That's because the commission agreed with that. No one testified that there was any harm. That's an extenuating consideration. Another one is the disproportionality of the punishment. As we all know from criminal sentencing and other matters, that the punishment ought to fit the offense. In this case, the arbitrator determined that one charge was partially proven, and given these constellation of extenuating circumstances, it was too harsh and too disproportionate to fire a 21-year excellent employee. So the arbitrator agreed that some punishment was appropriate, and that's why he imposed the one-month unpaid suspension. And that was what he was there
Mr.
to
Tanik,
do.
That was his job. Your time is up.
So we would ask that the decision be affirmed and Mr. Knudsen be reinstated, the job that he has done so well for so long. Thank you.
Thank you. So with that, we will reset the clock for 5 minutes of rebuttal, and you can begin when you're ready, Ms. Tabbert.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just a couple of clarifications on points of fact. First, the jurisdictional decision by the Court of Appeals is not currently under review at the Supreme Court. There is a petition for review that has not been determined yet, in which the DOC has opposed. Second, just cause is defined in the statute. That's 43A33 subdivision 2, which defines just cause to include insubordination and other serious violation of policies. And three, a code of ethics violation means that the employee shall be subject to disciplinary action, not may be subject. And that's a very important distinction to make, because it means that the code of ethics violation that is demonstrated by the findings of fact of the arbitrator himself must result in discipline. If your honors don't have any further questions, there are a few other factual. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I had to find the button. All right, what's your response to Mr. Tanik's argument that just cause is related to extenuating circumstances, and in labor law, things you would look at include length of service, performance, lack of harm, and disproportionality? Do those factors have any relevance in assessing whether there have been extenuating circumstances in this case?
I think that certainly those factors do have some relevance. I would direct the court to the DOC's response, though, the reply, in which we cite the definition of extenuating from Black's Law Dictionary, which states that it has to mitigate the severity of the incident itself rather than, you know, the whole constellation of the employee's employment history. So I think that from that definition of extenuating, it should have a close tie to the actual severity of the misconduct. So,
can you tell me where that is in your brief? And I'm sorry, I missed that. And that's important. And I appreciate you having it in your brief.
Yes, that is in a footnote. I don't believe I know which footnote it is, but there's not that many footnotes. So it's one of the footnotes in the reply brief.
In the reply. Thank you. I will find it.
Yes. And also, I want to emphasize that the standard stated in 43A does not mush together just cause and extenuating circumstances. So once there is just cause, the only reason you can modify the discipline is if there are extenuating circumstances. That's not a proportionality test. It's, you know, about whether the record shows extenuating circumstances. And our argument is that the record does not support the extenuating circumstances that the arbitrator found, especially in light of the position of public trust that Knudsen held. So there was some discussion about the chair, the Min Core chair that Mr. Knudsen solicited from Al Larson. I want to be clear that the texts related to that are in the record in Joint Exhibit 1 at Bates number Joint 0106 through 0111. And it's clear that Knudsen asked for the price of the chair, found out that it was $250. then a few weeks later asked for it to be donated to his son's hockey league. And then after not getting a clear enough response from Al Larson, he offered $40 for it, which, based on the fact that he already knew it was $250, shows that he was trying to get special benefit for himself and for his son's hockey organization, which is a violation of the code of ethics. Also, the fact that Al Larson was not interviewed by the investigator is not strictly very relevant here, because Al Larson provided testimony in the evidentiary hearing, and so that testimony may be considered and was subject to be considered by the arbitrator. And the code of ethics does not require any coercion, so it doesn't really matter that Al Larson, who was Mr. Knutson's subordinate, didn't feel coerced. Also, his testimony about other incidences where MinCorps had donated items are described in the DOC reply. They include donating some yellowed paper to a school. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. And I hate to keep drilling down on this extenuating circumstances, but it's important. And I appreciate your footnote definition. That's helpful. An extenuating circumstance is one that makes the underlying misconduct less severe. So why wouldn't the fact that he didn't actually get anything, he was asking for a 32-cent mouse pad, do those things matter? I mean, what do you think we can look at? I mean, what is a conceivable extenuating circumstance in your view? I mean, on this set of facts, hypothetically, what would be an extenuating circumstance?
Well, one of the extenuating circumstances that the arbitrator identifies was Mr. Knudsen's distraught state of mind. And our response to that is, while it may have been a factor early on when he was placed on leave, he had time to cool off, and the record shows that he continued to violate the no contact directive after about 48 hours after 36 hours after he had been placed on leave. So that would be an example of something that might mitigate the severity of the misconduct, but doesn't
apply. And then going to his attempts to obtain privileges or goods that weren't available to the public, and he did that through the use of his position. What might be an extenuating circumstance to mitigate that? Or is it, as the arbitrator said, the DOC just has a zero tolerance policy? There can be no extenuating circumstance. If you try to get a 32-cent mouse pad as a result of your position, it doesn't matter that it's only 32 cents. It doesn't matter that you didn't get it. It doesn't matter that other people have done the same thing. It's zero tolerance. I mean, that seems to be your position. Is that the DOC's position?
The DOC's position is that, the statute mandates discipline for violations of the
code. Right, but it doesn't mandate discharge. It mandates discipline. Mm-hmm. And the arbitrator said discharge is too serious. He didn't say no discipline. He said, here are the reasons this particular form of discipline is inappropriate. So I guess I feel like I have to look at this and say, well, did the arbitrator articulate extenuating circumstances that justify his decision that termination was too harsh?
Well, I want to be clear that as to the code of ethics violations, the arbitrator did find no discipline because he found no violation. And if I may just briefly, Your Honors, a few more moments, a possible extenuating circumstance for code of ethics violations could be that it was an isolated incident. Here, it wasn't an isolated incident. There were three clear incidents in a short period of time where Mr. Knudsen attempted to use his position, and so we would not consider that to apply. With that, unless the panel has any further questions, I'll ask that the arbitrator's decision be reversed and the reinstatement, and that the discharge be reinstated. Thank you very much.
I recognize that we've gone a bit over on time, but does the panel have any other questions?
No, and I appreciate the questions. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. We really appreciate, and this is to both lawyers, appellant and respondents counsel. We